King Rock to speak with Galanor before the landscape distracted him. "I've been around creatures that exude a magical aura before," Galanor continued, "but I've never experienced..." The elf looked at his hands in disbelief. "I can feel their power rolling over my skin, as if my entire body is vibrating." "I feel it too," Gideon replied. "Except for the mage, it felt as if a warm aura had settled inside his chest and continued to pulse throughout his body. Being here, I feel safe and content, happy even." "I know what you mean." Galanor's smile didn't reach his eyes. "But you can't be sure, can you? Do you feel safe and content? Or is your happiness a simple reflection of their own?" Gideon looked from Galanor to the dragons flying above. He had already thought about the elf's comment and wondered if the dragon's unique method of communication was affecting his own emotions. The beating of mighty wings preceded the melodic voice of Adriel. "I assure you, Galanor of House Reveri, when a dragon wishes to communicate with you, you will know about it." Both Gideon and Galanor rose to their feet as a dragon, coated in ebony scales that glittered with silver, landed atop the floating boulder. Its thick neck drooped and lowered a head the size of a horse, allowing them a better view of Adriel, who was sitting astride the dragon between two spikes. The last of the dragorn slid from his perch and landed gracefully between the dragon's chest and wing. "This is Galandavax." Adriel stepped aside and swept his arm to encompass the spectacular creature. "He and I have been paired for 1,700 years now." Galandavax shook his mighty head before arching back on his hind legs and taking off into the sky. "Alas, he would sleep now. I apologize for my absence. I realize that you both have a lot of questions, and I left so suddenly after you arrived. Galandavax and I have always hunted together, you see, and when he decides to hunt, there is nothing that can stop him." "You've been hunting for a 10-day?" Galanor asked. Gideon could hear the frustration in the elf's voice. For a 10-day they had been left to their own devices in a land they didn't know, surrounded by the best predators in the world, and no answers as to why Dragon's Reach even existed. "Galandavax requires several tons of meat to sate his appetite." Adriel walked over the soft moss with bare feet. Gideon took special note of the green moss that grew in abundance around his feet, as if drawn to Adriel. The elf's usual flowing robes were now fastened tightly around his waist with several belts. The elf had no weapons but a simple yet ornate dagger sheathed across his waist. Adriel placed himself in the center of the boulder and sat cross-legged, while his long blonde hair blew gently in the breeze about him. The elf had an air of calmness to him that put Gideon at ease, almost imitating the way of the dragons and casting his own empathy over them. "We have a lot of questions." Galanor stepped closer to Adriel, but remained standing over the dragorn. "But more than that, we are running out of time. The queen, our queen, Adelandra Savari, is a prisoner of the Darkerkin. She's being kept in the palace in Malaysi. But I don't know how long they will keep her alive. Before we found her, she was forced to fight in the barbaric arena." Galanor couldn't go on, and Gideon could hear the despair in his voice. They both knew there was a good chance Adelandra was dead by now. "No," Adriel stated flatly to the unasked question. Galanor looked around at the flying dragons in disbelief before turning his angry gaze back to Adriel. "No? How can you say no? There are enough dragons here to raise Malaysi to the ground." With a sympathizing look, Adriel raised his hand to stop Galanor from shouting, but it was too late. The boulder shook when a dragon came to land behind the ancient elf, its emerald head pointed low and golden eyes fixed on Galanor. The striking green scales and sheer size of the dragon gave away its identity as Raynal, the Emperor Star, Queen of the Dragons. On the other side of Adriel, a smaller but no less awe-inspiring dragon also came to land, with its thick claws digging into the rock. The dazzling young dragon was called Ilargo. His scales had a lighter shade of green, and gold specks that twinkled in the dying light. Gideon recognized him from the arena in Malaysi, when Ilargo had been freed with another dragon called Bravog. Without warning, both Gideon and Galanor were overcome with the feeling of being insulted, as if Adriel had shouted at them in their home. The feeling only lasted for a few seconds, but it was enough to convey Raynal's irritation. They both took a breath and glanced at each other. Now they knew what it felt like to be spoken to by a dragon. "I'm afraid we cannot help you," Adriel said. "You saw it yourself, when Malaith dropped into the arena. The Darkkin captured and imprisoned Ilargo and Bravog over a month ago, before they were rescued upon your arrival in these lands. We attempted to reclaim them, but almost lost more dragons in the process. How did the Darkkin capture two dragons? Gideon asked. They don't even use magic. Even with magic, it is hard to bring down a dragon, Adriel explained. But with anti-magic, it is quite easy. What is anti-magic? Gideon looked to Galanor, who appeared similarly confused. I had never heard of it either during my time in Ilion, but Raynal and Galandavax told me of it. Adriel adopted a grave tone. Chrysalith, it was called. They knew it from another age, before even the elves walked the earth. The Darkkin must have discovered the stones, though I know not where. They appear as green crystals, but their beauty is deadly. Ilargo and Bravog were out hunting when the Darkkin sprung their trap. In the presence of the stones, the dragons grow weak, until they cannot even fly or breathe fire. The Darkkin sharpen them and fix them to spears for their hunts. You won't help us free Adelandra because you're afraid of some rocks? Galanor's tone was becoming aggressive again. Raynal took in a sharp breath and looked to Adriel. The two shared a moment of what appeared to be silence before the Emerald Dragon spread her wings and dropped off the side of the floating boulder. She continued to drop until at the last moment she glided over the tops of the trees, ducking and weaving between the floating rocks. Ilargo remained behind and padded along behind Adriel, always watching Gideon as he did. The mage felt scrutinized by those boring blue eyes, as if the dragon was looking into him. "Dragons are the fiercest, most noble and honorable of all creatures," Adriel said in the wake of Raynal's dramatic departure. "But with nobility and honor comes sensitivity. The first rule of living among dragons, stay on their good side." Adriel smiled and rose to his feet, when Ilargo dipped his horned head affectionately to the elf's shoulder, his stunning eyes always on Gideon. "Should you wish to return to Ilion, Galandavax will take you both as far as the Black Road, in the north. From there you can journey to wherever our people have settled in Ada. I'm sure they will see you return to the west safely." The Black Road? Gideon had seen the name on the map he had stolen from the pyramid in Malaysi. The mage pulled the parchment out of his satchel and unraveled it with both hands. "Our people live south of the Crystal Sea, in the Amara. The city is called Delandril. You may have heard the name," Galanor said. Adriel tilted his head, guarding his expression. "Named for the first Dragorn. His lineage is followed by our king, Elim Sivari, whose wife, our queen, is a prisoner in Malaysi." Adriel's calm demeanor was obviously irritating Galanor, and Gideon could feel the awkward tension building between the two elves. Gideon cleared his throat. "The Black Road is beneath a desert, by the looks of this." The mage held up the map for the others to see. "It's 250 miles of sand," Galanor grimly replied. "Once we reach Eternity's Edge, it's another 200 miles until the nearest river. It's a death sentence." "Queen Adelandra made the journey," Adriel pointed out. "You're just afraid we'll tell others of this place." Galanor was like a dog with a bone. "You've lived in this paradise for so long that you have forgotten the rest of the world. All of Verda is about to be plunged into a war to end all wars, and you're living with the very creatures that could tip the scale. We need to free the queen, warn the Ilians, and somehow find a way to ally them with King Elim. 3 Darkkin armies are marching into Ilion as we speak." "The answer is still no, I'm afraid." Galanor snarled in a very un-elf-like way. "The Dragorn I read about were warriors all. They rode their dragons into battle and knew no fear. It should be you leading us against Valens's forces." "You have been greatly misinformed about the Dragorn." Adriel strolled to the edge of the boulder, calm as ever. "The Dragorn were peacekeepers where needed, but it was never enforced through violence, only wisdom. And you don't ride a dragon. No one rides a dragon." Adriel stepped off the boulder without warning and dropped from sight. Gideon gasped and ran for the edge with Galanor. The pair jumped back in surprise when Galandavax's hulking form soared into the sky, past the floating boulder, with Adriel sat at the base of his thick neck. The two were perfectly in sync with each other, always aware of where the other was and what they were thinking. Gideon could only look on in amazement, unlike Galanor. "Then we will go!" Galanor shouted at the shrinking image of Galandavax. The elf reached down and collected his scimitars from the ground. "I will not let her rot inside that city." Before Gideon could offer any advice, The elf hopped off the side and half-climbed, half-slid down the boulder with incredible speed. The mage sighed. I only just got up here. A guttural yet apparently questioning sound reverberated inside Ilargo's meaty throat. The blue-eyed dragon was off to the side, looking at Gideon with his head tilted like an inquisitive dog. Nice dragon. The mage slowly stepped back, hoping to all the gods that Ilargo had already eaten. Galanor strode through the central meadow that sat under the canopy of the dozen floating boulders. The sights and sounds around him were serene and calming, yet they did nothing to soothe his mood. How could Adriel be so passive? How could creatures with so much power sit back and hide in their crater? As the sun dropped below the red mountains, the shadows of the flying dragon ceased to glide across the ground. A cool night air settled on the valley, and the elf wrapped his cloak a little tighter around his arms. Galanor was drawn to the waterfall that poured out of the protruding mountain. He circumnavigated the giant pool at its base and climbed the smaller rocks until he found a way into the cave, behind the waterfall. It was dark but oddly warm, offering comfort in his dour mood. Galanor sat in the middle of the cave, facing the wall of rushing water. The roar was hypnotic and helped to calm him. As an elf, Galanor's emotions had the potential to control him, forcing him to take action he might later regret. The elf dropped his head and sighed, trying desperately not to think about the horrors Adelandra would be experiencing in Malaysai. He thought about what else might be going on in the world. What would King Elim do now that Maliath hadn't been returned to him? Would they still invade? Would it affect the timescale of the war? Then he thought about his betrothed, Rhaena. The princess had been promised to him by the king when he agreed to bring back Maliath. Would the wedding be off now that he had failed? It was a trivial detail in the madness of everything else, but it didn't stop him from wondering. The diviner on the back of his belt weighed heavy on his mind. He could, if he wished, contact Morrigan, or even the king to discover the answers to his questions. Galanor wasn't up to speaking with the king, even to inform him that Adelandra was a prisoner of the Darkerkin. He knew he was a coward for that, but he still hoped to save her, and by saving the queen, there was always the chance that the king would forgive him for failing on the mage's island of Corcanath. There was that voice again, the voice of his duty-bound conscience finding a solution that allowed him to keep his honor and stay in favor with the king and the highborn families. Galanor had promised himself that when the opportunity arose, he would seek out some kind of new freedom and life in the world. A life where he didn't need to pick up his blades and make decisions that ended the life of another. A part of him still wanted that life, and despaired at the thought of the fighting he would have to endure in order to achieve it. Galanor couldn't walk away from the fact that all the land was about to be plunged into war, and that shadowy figures were manipulating everything from behind the scenes. He didn't want to witness the genocide of mankind at the hands of his own kin, though he didn't mind the idea of wiping out the Darkerkin and their evil ways. Galanor wasn't stupid enough to believe that the war could be averted with words, and that peace would only come after a bloody fight, but he knew the dragons would bring a swift end to any conflict. Adelandra had birthed that vision and been right about where to find them. It was almost enough to give the elf faith and trust in the echoes of fate. He lacked the conviction that Adelandra wore on her sleeve. If anyone could convince Adriel and the dragons to help, it would be Adelandra. How he would save her without them, he couldn't fathom, however. He had no crystals to help him open a portal, and he had no idea how to climb out of the crater. There was a reason Adriel had named it Dragon's Reach, after all. Galanor was tired and out of answers. Without really thinking about it, the elf reached around his back and removed the diviner orb from its pouch. The black sphere sat in the palm of his hand, almost weightless. Galanor decided he would have some answers, even if it was just for peace of mind. Pouring his magical aura into the orb, Galanor called for Morrigan's own diviner to receive his consciousness. In the dark of the cave, the only light from the waterfall, the elf waited for a response. It took some time, but eventually Galanor felt himself being pulled into another realm where only shades could exist. He couldn't hide his surprise when he saw an ethereal form of a female elf instead of Morrigan. It was impossible to discern any great detail while in this plane of existence, but Galanor still recognized her, even if he couldn't place her name. I know you. I am Phelan of House Haldor. the elf replied with a curt smile. Now Galanor knew where he had seen her. Phelan had always been present in court and never far behind Princess Rhaena. I am Galanor of House Reverie, Phelan said before he could finish introducing himself. I know who you are and the nature of your mission. Phelan had an air of desperation about her now. Tell me everything, Galanor. Where is Maliath? Galanor hadn't quite gotten over the shock of seeing someone other than Morrigan. He also didn't like the way Phelan demanded answers. What's wrong? He asked. Has something happened? Where's Princess Rhaena? Where's Morrigan? Phelan's ethereal face looked away for a moment. Morrigan is dead. He was killed by what we suspect to be a member of the Hand. Before Galanor could question her more on that most shocking statement, his physical body detected another presence in the cave. The elf paused, becoming detached from the conversation as he considered who else could be inside the cave. Or what else? That fighter instinct that never went away told him to prepare for violence. He disengaged from the diviner immediately and without warning to Phelan. In the blink of an eye, Galanor was back in the dark cave and up on his feet. Two startling purple eyes appeared in the dark, followed by a giant black head, which took shape in the shadows. Maliath's breath blew Galanor's chestnut hair out behind him and threatened to overwhelm his keen elven nose. The dragon's low growl continued to rise in pitch and aggression, and his four well-muscled legs brought him ever closer. Galanor hadn't been around dragons for very long, but he could see the rage in those violet eyes, and he was thankful that Maliath wasn't pushing those emotions on him. Instead, that fighter instinct kicked in, and was very clear in its decision that running away was his only option. Using every ounce of his elven reflexes, Galanor turned on the spot and dashed for the waterfall. Maliath's roar filled the cave, and four booming legs ran after him, until the elf dived through the wall of water and dropped into the pool below. The cold water hit Galanor like a fist to the chest, but the threat of Maliath allowed him to ignore it and push on for the shore. He had barely taken his first breath when the black dragon burst forth from the waterfall and plummeted towards him, claws outstretched. At the last second, when Galanor had been sure his life was about to come to an end, a green blur slammed into Maliath and sent the black dragon flying into the trees beyond the pool. Galanor steadied himself in the water and watched as Rhaenyl, the Emerald Star, batted Maliath's claws away and held him down. Their mighty tails swung from side to side, crushing and snapping trees like twigs, uprooting ancient rocks with ease. Rhaenyl entwined Maliath's tail in her own and clamped both of them down to the ground, launching a wave of dirt high into the air. Maliath thrashed under her weight and snapped at her neck with his powerful jaws, but Rhaenyl managed to evade every bite. The sound of giant wings soared overhead, followed by Galandavax, who swooped out of the night sky and landed beside the struggling dragons. With an ear-piercing roar, Galandavax dropped his heavy front claw onto Maliath's head and kept it there, as if the black dragon was caught in a vice. Maliath roared and continued to struggle until another dragon dropped out of the sky. The red scales gave his identity away as Dolvasari, the Stormmaker. Together they held Maliath in place and waited for him to calm down. It will be some time before we break through the years of imprisonment he suffered under human mages. Adriel appeared at Galanor's side after he emerged from the pool. Both elves could only look on, with the dragon struggling to contain the giant Maliath. "He's angry," Galanor observed. "And yet we cannot blame the humans," Adriel continued. "They do only what is in their nature." "Dragons live just as long as elves," Galanor said, baiting Adriel. "Longer, perhaps. The mages kept him as a prisoner for nearly 1,000 years, and now he's broken, an echo of his former glory." Galanor turned away from the spectacle of dragons and looked at Adriel. "Adelandra could live just as long, except instead of human mages who pay her no heed, she will be tortured by the Darkerkin. Seeing Maliath now, don't you wish you could have done something all those years ago?" Adriel looked to reply, but his jaw clamped shut. Galanor knew he wouldn't change Adriel's mind so easily, and didn't expect to after one conversation. Instead, he turned away and left the ancient elf to think on his words. As the cold water ran down his face, Galanor slipped between the trees as a new idea began to surface in his mind. Perhaps there was a way he could save Adelandra after all. Before he could fully form the new idea, Galenor's thoughts flew to the west, to Ilion. The elf reached around his back in search of his diviner, only to be alarmed by its absence. He must have left it in the cave, or dropped it in the pool. "Galenor, you fool!" the elf berated himself. Chapter 7 The House of Owls. An ocean of stars hung over the city of Carath, its flat rooftops illuminated under the stark light of the full moon. The daytime heat of the arid lands had been replaced with its usual icy chill. Like a bird of prey, Torin, son of Nun, crouched low over the corner of a warehouse located at the edge of the city. The district was usually quiet at this time of night, with most of the inhabitants either sleeping or drawn to Carath's entertainment district in the heart of the city. At least that's how it used to be. Now the city was overflowing with violent retribution. In the distance, Torin could make out a range of fires that worked to burn down temples and grand houses, the smoke rising to block out the stars on the horizon. The capital of the arid lands had reached its tipping point 7 years ago, when the slaves outnumbered the privileged free peoples. It had barely taken a nudge to plunge the city into chaos. Now, almost a decade later, the slaves were taking back their years of forced servitude at the end of a blade. Initially, the Emperor's forces had pushed back, and severely. Many slaves were made an example of around the clock, with public executions and floggings. Their efforts had only helped to fuel Torin's rage. Now, at 24, the young man had spent his adult life fighting for the freedom his parents never had. Like all those he had grown up with, his parents had only two options available to them when their child was born. Offer him to their masters, who could do with the babe as they saw fit, or whisk the infant away in secret, risking all their lives in the process. But that was before Mother Madakiai. The elderly ex-priestess of Fimir, the god of wisdom, took in every stray slave and child she could find. Her orphanage was run in the shadows and kept away from the masters. It was there that Torin found an education and opportunities he would never have received as a slave. Of course, Mother Madakiai's orphanage had only ever been known as the House, until Torin came up with a new name, a name that grand families would come to fear. Torin looked away from the effects of the very war he had incited, and fixed his gaze firmly on the adjacent warehouse, where he counted every armed guard he could see. There was once a time when the slavers of the southern lands would flaunt their power and boast to their friends. They would openly trade in lives, as if they were trinkets on a market stand, and laugh as their wealth grew off the misery of others. For 7 years, Torin had worked tirelessly to turn the orphanage of would-be slaves into a force to be reckoned with. Now the guards were quiet and wary of what terrors the night brought. Now they transported the slaves across the arid lands in the middle of the day, and with as much secrecy as possible. The slaves were moved a lot, and the locations always changed at the last minute. This particular group of slaves were owned by Orfad Val Agad, a grossly overweight man with ties to the great families that ran the city and now controlled their young emperor. Trading in lives was only one of Orfad's services to the people of Carath. He also expedited the transport of minerals and supplies from Namdor, the capital in the north. Such minerals were used in the production of armor and weapons for the emperor's armies. This was a fact that gave Torin pause. The guards were numerous and all were well armed with fine weapons, but Torin couldn't pass up the opportunity in front of him. Not only could he free these slaves, but the information that came by his owls informed him that Orfad Val Agad was also present inside the warehouse. Apparently this particular group of slaves were being transported to Amuraska at dawn, and Orfad wanted to see the transport off himself. "Everyone is in position, Torin," Rego, son of Nun, announced from behind. "Excellent. Make certain they know their place in all this. They are to follow only. Anyone who gets out of that building did so because I wanted them to. Let us see where the rats run to when the fat man is dead." Torin stood to his full height at 6 feet, and turned to greet Brago, his oldest and most loyal friend. Despite giving Brago the instructions, Torin knew that his friend had already taken care of the details. "Are you sure I cannot accompany you?" Brago asked, as he always did. "We all have our gifts, and the House of Owls uses them all," Torin assured. "This strike must be surgical if the slaves are to be freed and Orfad slain." Torin would never doubt Brago's fighting ability, or that of any of his owls, since he had been the one to teach them all following his own instruction. but the skills required for tonight were specific to Torin alone. Mother Medaki, I will be displeased if we aren't back by dawn, Rago added with a smirk. By dawn, Mother Medaki, I will have over a dozen new sons and daughters. Torin matched his friend's smile, and the two gripped each other's forearms, as they always did, before death was given its next opportunity to claim them. See you on the other side, brother. Rago handed over the white helmet that Torin had crafted on his 19th birthday 5 years ago. Though covered in scratches and the odd deep cut, the visage was still plain to see. Torin placed the mask and helmet over his head and knew that Rago now looked upon the face of the White Owl. The facial features of the encompassing helmet were simple in craftsmanship, but undoubtedly that of an owl. Only his eyes could be seen through the large owl-shaped sockets, a fact that pleased Torin. He had heard it said that the window to the soul lay in the eyes, and he hoped it to be true. For when his enemies saw his own, they would witness nothing but rage and fury. The White Owl threw the black cloak over his brown leather shoulder pads and pulled the hood over his painted helmet. From head to toe he was adorned in daggers, short swords, hidden blades, smoke pellets, and a simple four-armed hook and rope that hung from the side of his belt. He was walking death, as he had been trained to be. Turning back to the edge, Torin swept the area in search of his owls, but was glad that he couldn't spot a single one. He had trained them well. Having already planned his entry, Torin leapt from the top of the warehouse and flung his hook across the street, where it snagged against the lip of the roof. The white owl swung between the buildings until he could drop onto a platform built from scaffolding that was still attached to the side of the building. He was careful to shift his weight as he landed, ensuring his stealthy approach. A practiced flick of the wrist brought his hook back to him in a flash. I'm just saying, we could have some fun with the pretty one before we see them off, a bald guard wielding a wide scimitar offered to his friend. The other was a typical Karathan, with thick dark hair and tanned skin, wielding a double-edged axe. Orfad would know, the axeman replied. He doesn't like the merchandise damaged. Then we'd be careful, the bald one added, slyly. Then you'll be dead, Torin interrupted, with an acrobatic flip off the scaffolding. The white owl landed between the surprised guards, who couldn't even lift their weapons before Torin buried a dagger in each of their foreheads. They died instantly, without a sound, but he was careful to lower them both to the ground, using the buried blades to leverage their weight. Torin left the bodies and proceeded to climb back up the scaffolding, having had no intentions of entering the warehouse via the main door. He just needed to ensure that those inside would have no help from the men outside. Back on the rooftop, Torin made for the double doors, built on a slant, which led into the building. He quickly picked the lock and slowly opened one of the doors to avoid it creaking. The white owl dropped down onto the balls of his feet and rolled forward to absorb the landing. With a dagger already in hand, Torin came out of his roll ready for a fight. But there was none to be had. Light shone through the floorboards from the room beneath him, where deep voices drifted up to greet him. Torin moved swiftly down the only set of stairs and dashed up the wall so that he could use the wooden beams to observe his prey. The four-story warehouse was now sprawled out below him, its secrets laid bare. The room from which he had heard voices was to his right, where he could now see the plump Orfad Val Agad talking to his thugs. Torin moved silently along the beams until he could see through the window and get a better look at what the men were crowding around. There looked to be a map of some kind on the table, but Torin was too far away to see the details. Whatever it was, Orfad was very animated in his instructions. "They must be ready by then," the fat man spat. "Any delay will see our heads mounted on Scylla's gate. This is to be the last transport out of the city. After tonight, all slaves are to be sent to the forges, understand?" Torin's interest was piqued, but he had to focus on the slaves below. If he killed Orfad too soon, he ran the risk that the others would be alerted and the slaves would be put in jeopardy. Prioritize. The voice of his old mentor, Salim al-Anan, rang clearly in his mind. The blind hatred he felt for the slavers fueled him, sharpening his mind and focusing his senses. If he was to make an impact on the great families, he would have to be smart about it. He couldn't crush an empire and bring about a revolution by marching an army and swinging his sword at every slaver, even though he wanted to. He had to bring them down in the eyes of the people, give the slaves hope and the possibility of a better life. But most of all, Torin wanted them to feel the same fear his parents had felt, the fear every slave lived with. The slaves were easy to spot on the ground floor. Two columns of cages, either side of a large wagon, were both filled to burst with men, women, and children. Torches lined the four floors, illuminating the many guards that wandered up and down, mostly pretending to pay attention. Torrin couldn't see a single slaver that didn't look dead on his feet. It had been too long since the owl's last raid. The slavers had forgotten the bite of his blades and the deadly accuracy with which he could throw them. The white owl took a moment to single out the ones he wouldn't kill. They were the ones that he would simply allow to run away. The cowards would spread his legend, as well as lead him to the next slave house. Torrin came to a stop in the center of the beam and gathered his black cape out behind him, noting the frayed edges and holes that marred the thick material. He would have to ask Mother Madakiai to repair it for him, as she often had. For just a moment, Torrin was taken back to his teenage years, when his mentor, Salim, would take him out on such expeditions. As one of the Emperor's personal guards, Salim was one of the best of all the warriors in Ilion. Torrin would watch as the older man showed him the best way to take down multiple targets in a single, fluid movement, for speed was the key. Salim had always planned every step of his attack before moving a muscle, and so too did Torrin. The dagger slipped from the sheath at the base of his back with perfect ease. The balance felt right in his hand while he twirled it end over end. Torrin held the knife out, tip down, and steadied his arm, waiting for the perfect moment. He took a deep breath from within his armored helmet and released the blade from his grip. Before the dagger dropped all four floors and plunged into the passing slaver's head, Torrin had already attached his hook to the beam and swung down to the second floor, where another slaver was strolling by. In perfect synergy, the dagger dived into the ground floor slaver's head as Torrin flew into the second floor guard. The white owl drove one of his many daggers into the man's heart before swiveling on the spot and throwing it at the slaver on the opposite side of the second floor. The blade spun across the expanse and ended its journey in the slaver's eye. In 5 seconds, he had already killed 3 of the guards. Torrin had no intention of stopping there. He was already jumping over the railing and on top of the wagon before the dagger impacted the third guard's eyeball. In the same way that many animals changed their shape to appear threatening, so too could Torrin. He flipped backwards off the wagon and held his cape out wide like the wings of an owl, blocking the light from above and scaring the guards beside the wagon. As predicted, one of the slavers screamed and ran for the nearest door, while the other fancied his chances at making a name for himself. Torrin kept his blades in their sheaths and evaded the guard's swing until he presented the perfect opportunity. Slipping under the wide swing was easy, almost as easy as snapping the slaver's arm and breaking the bone. A swift fist to the face shattered his nose and sent the man stumbling from the building with a wobbly arm. The sound of rushing feet and calls for help could be heard above. Torrin stepped over the guard with a dagger buried in the top of his head, ducking only to retrieve the blade, and made for his new prey. The slaves called out from within their cages, begging to be set free, with their arms outstretched through the square gaps in the bars. Torrin was only too happy to oblige, and removed one of the 2 short swords strapped to his back, positioned so that the hilts were always facing downwards. A strong swing saw the meaty padlocks broken, and the slaves flooded out. "Through there!" Torrin directed them to the correct exit. "Follow the owls." On the other side of the double doors, 3 of his trusted owls were waiting, each wearing a white mask similar to his own. 2 slavers descended the stairs and dropped onto the ground floor, brandishing a mace and a sword. Torrin lifted a pair of daggers from his hips and stood his ground, waiting for the guards to approach. First one to come at him appeared fresh off the street, with an obvious lack of tattoos or scars. He had no idea what was about to happen to him. With one blade, Torrin batted the slaver's sword away and rushed forward, bringing his other dagger to bear horizontally. In a second, he was standing between the slaver wielding a mace and the now dead swordsman, whose throat gushed blood over the floor. The mace wielder lunged with his weapon held high and an expression somewhere between terror and rage. It didn't matter. Torrin threw one of his daggers into the man's chest and laid him low in an instant. Without missing a beat, the white owl caught the mace in midair and flung it at the next guard, rushing down the stairs. The heavy mace cracked his knee and forced the man to roll down the steps in a heap. Torrin dropped to one knee and drove his knife into the slaver's heart, before jumping back up and flicking the same blade at the guard at the top of the stairs. He too collapsed in a heap and rolled down the steps, dead. The cries of the slaves from the other side of the wagon stopped Torin from continuing up the stairs and killing the rest. Once again, he used one of his short swords to cut the padlock in half. The slaves thanked him and reached out to touch their hero, a proven distraction. Torin only saw the arrow after it had flown by his head, skimmed the lip of his dark hood, and dug deep into the chest of an old man. His attention focused, the creaking of more bowstrings had the white owl spinning away, hoping to take their aim away from the slaves. He raised the black cloak across his body to hide his true size, forcing the second archer to miscalculate and fire his arrow through the material. Torin responded with one of his heavier throwing knives and launched it up to the second floor, where the blade ended its journey in the archer's head. "Run!" Torin hurried the slaves out as the next archer notched an arrow.
"For too long you have been a thorn in my enterprise," Orfad shouted down from the top floor, his fat head leering over the railing. "Whoever brings me his head can live in my whorehouse."
More feet resounded from above as the slavers took up the challenge. Torin used his youth and agility to jump on top of the wagon, between the slave cages. The arrow thudded into the wood, only an inch beneath his rising foot. He continued to run across the wagon and jump up to the first floor, where he swiped the legs of an oncoming slaver. Once on his back, Torin crouched over the top of him and dropped his reinforced mask onto the guard's head, breaking his nose and rendering him unconscious. He would have quite the story to tell when he awoke. Another arrow whistled through the air and dug into the wooden beam beside Torin's arm. The white owl made for the stairs and threw a small bag of tallow spices across the gap, his aim perfect. The bag of spices flew into the mounted torch behind the archer and exploded in a flash of blinding light. Torin's helmet muted some of the sound, allowing him to keep his senses, unlike the archer, who dropped his bow and covered his bleeding ears as he stumbled around without his sight. Torin ran around the warehouse, ascending every stairwell and throwing his blades at every angle. Slavers dropped and fell over the railings on every floor. Those who evaded his throws experienced a crueler death after Torin unleashed his hand-to-hand combat and shattered bones. It wasn't long before Torin found himself back on the top floor, standing before Orfad's office. 16 men lay dead behind him, and the 17th was already sweating and praying to the gods. Torin kicked the door in so hard it broke the top hinges and deformed the door. Orfad yelped and jumped back with a bundle of scrolls and parchments screwed up in his arms. The white owl slowly drew his favorite dagger from the strap across his chest, making certain that Orfad saw every inch of the blade that was going to end his life. The hilt of the dagger was sculpted into the shape of an owl, its head forming the pommel. Seeing no way of escaping his fate, Orfad's fear turned to anger.
"You have changed nothing, White Owl. Long after your body is dust, men like me will continue to trade in the lives of the weak."
Orfad laughed nervously.
"You have no idea what's coming. The House of Owls will crumble under Valinus."
Torin had heard enough. All he could see was red. The White Owl launched over the table and pinned the fat slaver to the wall. The blade was too clean a kill for this monster, and Torin's rage had reached its crescendo. With Orfad's head gripped between Torin's hands, he thrust his own head into the slaver's again and again. He headbutted Orfad over and over until the white of his mask was dripping red with blood. By the time he released the head, the fat man was unrecognizable. It took several minutes before Torin regained his breath and calmed down enough to focus on the scrolls Orfad had clung to. He removed the folded parchments and took note of the heavy ring on the slaver's finger. He had seen identical rings on previous targets, each one always embellished with the image of a sun and a black diamond in the center. The New Dawn. Torin had been trying to root out every member of the shadowy cult, who, from what he had already discovered, had secretly ruled the South for decades, possibly even longer. He wiped the blood from his faceplate with one of Orfad's expensive handkerchiefs and unraveled the parchments across the desk.
"What is this?"
Torin looked over records and drawings of various pieces of armor. It was a receipt of some kind, with an order in the thousands. Torin continued to unravel more parchment and pored himself over the information,
Orfad was procuring tons of material and ore from the north to make armor and weapons for an army larger than any in the arid lands. And who was this Valinus, he mentioned? Another slaver, perhaps? Or another member of the New Dawn? The White Owl took the scrolls and the map and descended the warehouse, as he tried to put the pieces of the puzzle together. The archer, stunned by the tallow spices, was still staggering around the second floor when Torren walked by. He thought about leaving him, another witness to his devastating skills, when he remembered the old man the archer had killed. Torren shoved his favorite dagger up into the man's jaw until it pierced his brain and killed him instantly. It seemed a shame for the blade to have seen no blood, after all. Torren strolled outside without fear, ever aware that he was the most dangerous man on the streets. The sound of fighting and swords clashing were never too far away these days, as slaves and sympathizers took up arms against their oppressors. He knew that his owls weren't among the distant combatants, as he had them organized in other parts of the city. The White Owl always knew where they were and what goals he had assigned them. For just a moment, he feared what chaos he had inspired. How many slaves would die picking up his cause without ever even meeting him, or stepping foot in the House of Owls? How many were dying right now because of his anger? The sound of approaching hooves returned him to the moment in an instant. The White Owl dashed for the shadows of the alley and waited. Four black horses galloped down the dark street and came to an abrupt stop outside Orfad's warehouse. Torren knew these men to be members of the city guard and soldiers in the Emperor's army. Three of the riders wore their traditional silver and gold armor, with their helmets concealing their faces. The fourth rider, however, wore a long blue cloak over the top of his armor and didn't bother with a helmet. His authority came from recognition. "Check inside," the helmetless commander ordered. All four dismounted, and the three soldiers entered the warehouse with their swords drawn. The commander waited outside and looked around the empty streets and dark alleys, his hand always resting on the pommel of his sword. "Halion al-Anan," Torren called softly from the alley. The commander didn't flinch at the sound of his name, the seasoned warrior no doubt expecting such a call. Halion's olive skin and wavy dark hair were cast in shadows as he entered the alley, unafraid. Torren stepped out and made himself known, his hand still hidden within the black cape. Still, Halion walked towards him, with his gloved hand squeezing the hilt of his sword. Torren knew how fast Halion could remove that blade and plunge it into his opponent. At the point at which both men could strike the other down, Halion smiled, and Torren offered the commander his arm, who instead embraced the White Owl and pulled him in for a tight hug. "Good to see you, brother." Torren's voice was distorted by his mask. "And you." Halion's smile turned sour at the sight of the blood streaked across Torren's white mask. "Are you hurt?" "Of course not." Torren pulled away and removed his helmet and hood. "Your father taught me better than that." Halion's expression of relief quickly faded at the mention of his father, and Torren regretted his words instantly. For Torren, Salim al-Anan's exile from the arid lands was hard to deal with, and his loss weighed heavy on the White Owl's heart. But for Halion, the loss had been tenfold. Not only had the young warrior had to watch his father stripped of his rank, humiliated, and then exiled to the bitter north, but Halion had been forced to remain and carry his father's shame. Publicly acknowledging his father's mistakes had been the only way to distance himself from Salim and rise through the ranks. Halion's climb to second-in-command of the Emperor's army hadn't been an easy one, but a necessary one. "My father's lessons were instructive," Halion replied. "I only wish he had taken better heed of them himself." Torren had never stopped thinking about that night. The night Emperor Colossi and his wife had been slaughtered in their private chambers under Salim's very nose. Noise from the warehouse stopped Torren from dwelling on Salim, his adoptive father, and focus on the present. He looked beyond Halion to make certain that the soldiers weren't exiting the building and searching for their commander. "Don't worry," Halion bade. "They're trusted men." That didn't completely convince Torren. "How can you be sure they aren't loyal to Rorsach?" Just thinking about the supreme commander of the Emperor's forces made the White Owl's blood boil. Rorsach was an avid supporter of slavery and was most definitely a member of the New Dawn. Unfortunately, he was also Halion's direct commander. "I started separating my men from his men a long time ago, brother." Halion made a cursory glance over the surrounding rooftops and Torin knew he was searching for any other owls. "You need to kill him and be done with it," Torin said. "Slavery is an ancient evil that I wholeheartedly agree needs eradicating, but Rorschach will die at the right time. You talk of my father's training. Did he not teach you patience? The tide is still turning, and I'm not sure we would win in an all-out war right now." "Well, I think that's what they're preparing for." Torin handed over the stolen scrolls from Orfad's office. This can't be right." Halin looked over the parchments in confusion. "The order is too large. We don't even need this much armor or weapons." "Exactly. So who do you think is going to be wearing it all?" Torin pressed. "Who are they?" "The New Dawn, of course." Torin threw up his hands, exasperated. "The same cult that runs this country. That still doesn't answer why they have ordered so much material." Halion, ever the calm one, rolled up the scroll and handed it back to Torin. "I will investigate." "No, I will look into it," Torin quickly replied. "You will only appear suspicious if you go poking your nose into New Dawn's business any more than you already have. It's a miracle of the gods that they haven't already tried to indoctrinate you." Halion smiled. "That's a big word for an alley rat." Torin smiled at the nickname his adoptive brother had given him all those years ago, when Salamid first saved him from a beating in the streets, and seen something in Torin that no one had before. "Continue to sway more soldiers to our cause." Torin replaced his mask and hood. "I will look into this new development. Be safe, little brother." Halion was on his own in moments, as Torin slipped into the shadows and disappeared. Chapter 8 The Rangers. The Evermore surrounded them on their journey north, the natural sounds of the forest filling Rayna's ears and reminding her of home. If she closed her eyes and ignored the clopping of hooves, the princess could pretend she was back in the Amara. The mighty forest surrounded her home, Elandril, and was easily her favorite place in all of Ada. Though she didn't mind the smell of the human hubbub, she was appreciative of nature's scents, as was Ollie, who flew above them, following their trail. Alas, her mind could not find peace, even in the quiet of the wilds. Rayna could only think of Phelan's shocking news earlier this morning. Her mentor had spoken with Galanor. "He didn't say anything else?" the princess asked again. Phelan's sigh was not so subtle. "For the third time, no. And I couldn't get back in touch with him after he disconnected." "Was he in distress?" Rayna pressed. "It's hard to say. Diviners aren't the best way to hold a conversation." Phelan's body language suggested she thought the worst of Galanor's situation, but only Rayna could detect such subtleties. Nathaniel trotted up beside them. "So we don't know if he's with Meliath?" "We have to assume not, since King Elim was not aware of Galanor's whereabouts," Phelan replied through tight lips. Now it was Rayna's turn to sigh. The young elf had met Galanor several times before she left for Ilin's shores, in an effort to get to know her future husband. They had little in common. Galanor was a warrior, and one of the greatest at that, but he would make a terrible partner. The son of House Reveri was devoted to the invasion plan and set on seeing his family elevated. Only once had Rayna seen a glimmer of another elf behind Galanor's facade. She had seen it in his eyes during one of their escorted walks in the Amara. He would look at the distant lands with wonder in his heart, as Rayna so often had. But like her, Galanor was trapped within the plans of those around him. The princess looked back in her saddle for any sign of the ranger. Asher had told them to press on towards Lirion, situated in the center of the Evermore, while he retrieved Hector, his horse. The Silk Road remained void of any travelers behind them, however. Rayna was confident that Asher would find them before they reached the capital of Felgarn. Not long after the sun had set did the three travelers make camp. Phelan had wanted to stay close to the Silk Road so that Asher might see their campfire, but Nathaniel assured her that the ranger could find them anywhere. Rayna sat on the same log as Nathaniel and rested her head on the knight's shoulder. The princess could feel Phelan's judging gaze on her, but continued to enjoy the closeness all the same. The two had yet to rekindle any passion that lay between them since before the Battle of Westphalian. Aleth's death had hit them all hard, but no one more than Nathaniel. Only in the last day or so had she seen a difference in the night, but there was still a gap she didn't know how to cross. The young elf distracted herself and examined her new bow, marveling at the craftsmanship in the firelight. The black coating sparkled between the ancient runes that lined the limbs in gold. As an elf, Raina was more attuned to the world of magic than other reasonable beings, and so she could feel the power of the weapon humming in her hand. A part of her didn't want to use the bow, knowing how many innocent lives it had taken in the hands of its previous owner, Adelin Bovo. Since she had been the one to finally end the Dark Elf's life, and with his own bow, no less, it was only right that she claim it. The bow certainly couldn't be allowed to fall into the wrong hands and end up in the clutches of Valinus's generals again. In some way, she thought, the bow went perfectly with her quiver, enchanted to never run out of arrows. Raina's pointed elven ears picked up the sound of hooves before Nathaniel's did. Asher strolled into the clearing, guiding Hector by the reins in his hand. It was troubling to know that Asher had the skills to enter their camp undetected if he wished, though she held no fear of the ranger, but rather the assassins who possessed similar talents. "Any trouble?" Nathaniel asked, eyeing the short sword strapped across Asher's back in the shape of an X. The only way anyone was claiming Aladir's sword would be to prize it from Asher's dead body. "They won't know he's gone until morning," Asher replied casually, wrapping the reins around the branch of a tree. "Then get some rest," Phelan bade. "We ride for Lirin at dawn." Raina's eyes met with Nathaniel's and held a silent conversation. Emotions, new to both, were swirling around their minds. She didn't love him, or at least, she didn't think it was love. This was all too new for her. The princess's frustration was quick to tip her emotions over the edge, her elven urges rising to the surface. A part of her wanted to forget her self-proclaimed mission to destroy Valinus and bring peace to Verda, and instead run away with Nathaniel to some quiet place and be happy. That train of thought took her to the logical conclusion that she would inevitably outlive Nathaniel. The thought made her stomach lurch, and she broke eye contact and moved away from the knight, much to his surprise. He questioned her with a look, but the princess only smiled in return and lay beside Phelan. As the sun reached its apex the next day, the four companions broke free of the Evermore canopy and rode into the city of Lirin. Asher patted Hector on the neck, happy to have his trusted steed back. The new saddle would take some getting used to, but the ranger didn't mind. He was more irritated at losing his goods from the previous saddle. "It's beautiful," Raina exclaimed, taking in the forest city. The bulk of Lirin was located on the base of a small mountain, with its pointed roofs and elven-styled spires wrapping around the sides. The streets were cobbled and lined with shops and taverns that bustled with activity. The main street that branched off from the Selk Road ran through the middle of the city and continued up the slope of the small mountain. Asher watched the princess follow the path upwards until she saw the palace and grand houses that lay nestled between giant pine trees. "That's where Queen Isabella Harg lives," Nathaniel said, also watching the princess. "She rules..." "Oh, I know my Ilian history," Raina interjected. "It was once a great elven city before the Dark War. My parents grew up in this forest. Now Queen Isabella rules all of Felgarn, the region that surrounds the Evermore. The towns of Woodvale and Vangarth are loyal to her, the House of the Stag. Felgarn has stood between Alborn and the Icevales for centuries, a geographical deterrent to war between Velia and Greystone." Asher had to agree with her assessment. If not for Felgarn, in the heart of Ilion's landscape, the ranger was sure there would be nothing standing between King Rengar of Velia going to war with King Gregorn of Greystone. Theirs was a battle that had started hundreds of years before either was born. Though not before Asher was born. "I suppose that information would help if you were here to find our weaknesses," Nathaniel replied without looking at Raina's hurt expression. Asher could see the new friction between the two, but he couldn't find the cause. Offering advice to two young lovers was not something he was comfortable with, though even if he was, the ranger had no clue as to what he would say. Theirs was a love destined to end in tragedy, if not by their mission, then by their heritage. "Where to, ranger?" Phelan asked, no doubt sensing the same unease between the two. "Follow me." Asher steered Hector away from the main road and into the center of the eastern district of Lirin. Asher and Nathaniel took no precautions in regard to their appearance, but the elves continued to keep the wide hoods over their heads in a bid to conceal their pointed ears. Seeing armed people within the city limits was no shocking sight to the Lyrians, who had long been hunters. Still, Asher felt the enchanted short sword on his back drew attention. In truth, the ranger was uncomfortable having twin swords on his back again. The Arrakesh had always fought with twin short swords on their backs, but it was the first thing Asher changed when he exiled himself. It wasn't long before Asher found himself outside the only place that he had ever let his guard down. The tavern was unassuming and crammed between a row of shops and houses, with a simple sign hanging over the door. The pickaxe. Fenrir inspected the interior with a critical eye. We just call it the axe. Asher hopped off his saddle and walked Hector to the post outside the tavern. Who's we? Rayna asked, skeptically. You'll see, the ranger replied with a coy smile. The others tied off their horses' reins and walked up the short steps. The raucous noise from inside was surprising for the time of day, but Asher knew the tavern's popularity had continued to grow since he rescued Queen Isabella all those years ago. His ties to the tavern had caught the attention of many wanting to hear tales of the rangers that patrolled the land. "Is that a warthog?" Nathaniel asked incredulously. "With a saddle?" Indeed, there was a warthog, with a saddle strapped to its back, though it was no saddle a human would fit into. The animal's thick, curling tusks were decorated with golden bands to match the gold-laden saddle. Its light brown fur bristled as the hog snorted and pulled against its reins rebelliously. The familiar sight only made Asher smile all the more, and he realized that it had been too long since his last visit. The pickaxe was certainly teeming with patrons, with laughter erupting from every corner and tankards clanking in merriment. The companions weren't given a moment's notice from the drinkers when they walked up to the bar, avoiding the buxom maid carrying a tray of beers and the drunkards staggering away from their barstools. Nathaniel had visited Lyrian before, but had never seen this particular tavern. The knight noticed Asher's attention drift over to the gruff but dramatic voice by the far right wall, the tone often more a growl than any known speech. Though the speaker couldn't be seen through the throng of onlookers, he yelled above the others what sounded like an interesting tale about gobbers, a gangly and vicious race of monsters. Nathaniel's defenses came up when the companions were halted in front of the bar by a solid wall of man. Asher managed to stop before he walked straight into the hulking barbarian, who looked down on the ranger as if he were a bug. Wearing barely any armor, the man's bare chest and arms rippled with muscles and thick veins that protruded like worms on his taut skin. "Don't mind him," a stern voice said from behind the barbarian, who walked away, disappearing through the door beyond the bar without a word. "He's from the Iron Valley. You know what them northerners are like." Nathaniel saw a surprising smile light up Asher's face. The man behind the bar was wiping tankards with a cloth, while smiling from ear to ear. The ranger strode over to the barkeeper, and the two embraced forearms. Even though Nathaniel guessed the barkeeper to be older than Asher, the man's arms were well-formed and tight around his muscles, suggesting the simple barkeeper kept in better shape than the ranger, or even Nathaniel. With razored grey hair, thick, broad shoulders, and the singular scar that ran up from the top of his left eye and cut through his hairline, the axe's owner appeared an unusual breed. "Russell Mabry." Asher looked over the barkeeper, and Nathaniel followed his gaze to the pickaxe mounted on the wall. The wooden shaft was decorated with several dozen notches from end to end. A very unusual breed.
"Asher, you're not traveling alone?"
Russell asked with disbelief in his tone, his unnatural yellow eyes flickering across the companions' faces.
"It hasn't been an easy road that led us here," Asher replied seriously.
Russell looked at the ranger and lingered over his sword belt, bereft of an actual sword and the many cuts and gashes that marred his leather armor. That was apparently enough to spur the barkeeper into action.
"Follow me."
Russell made for the end of the bar.
"By Grarfath's balls,"
the overly gruff voice from the other side of the tavern roared.
"Step aside, step aside. Ah, shut it. I'll finish the tale tomorrow."
Asher rolled his eyes before smiling at Nathaniel's confused expression. From their vantage, all Nathaniel and the elves could see was an angry crowd of men and women being pushed aside by some invisible force. The small mob jeered and groaned in protest, until the group burst apart to reveal a well-armored dwarf. Only his hands and face could be seen, besides the intricate black and gold armor that plated every inch of him. His long blonde hair was pulled tight at the back of his head, where it flowed over his shoulders and mixed with his beard, which ran down to his waist and ended in a tidy braid.
"I knew it was ye," the dwarf exclaimed, as he stomped over towards the companions and punched Asher in the leg.
Nathaniel had moved his